Company against Ferrous Miner Holdings. Mr. Binnick.
May it please the Court, Christian Binnick of the law firm Mayer Brown, LLP, on behalf of Appellant Illinois Bell Telephone. In our opening brief, we identified 3 points of error by the District Court. Today, I will address 2 of those 3 points.
Well, you also raised a jurisdictional question asking whether there was jurisdiction over your own appeal, and I certainly understand why you raised that. I would appreciate it if you would discuss that. That's logically first. The second issue in this case is whether the District Court had subject matter jurisdiction, a question that nobody has discussed, but this looks to me like a contract case without diversity of citizenship. So I would like to hear the parties' views on subject matter jurisdiction, but I think that's where we need to start.
You'd like me to start first with subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honor?
Well, jurisdiction is logically first, because if we don't have jurisdiction, the only thing we can do is dismiss the appeal.
Well, let me start with that issue, which is the third issue that we raised as a point of error, Your Honor, and that is the entry of the 54B judgment by the District Court. The District Court's order granting Ferrous Miner's motion to dismiss was not an appropriate decision for entry of a 54B judgment. Ferrous Miner, who requested the entry of the 54B judgment, was the prevailing party on the motion to dismiss.
Yeah, it may or may not have been appropriate. The District Court did make the findings required by the rules.
It did parrot the rules, Your Honor, but it did not explain them.
It made the findings required by the rules. The question, well, let me step back. The cases your brief cites are cases that involve sending a particular claim for appeal, even though the party remains pending in the court. This is a case in which the District Court has sent one party for appeal while other parties remain pending in the District Court. The question I have for you is whether we have ever demanded some particular analysis when one party has been fully wrapped up in the District Court.
I believe you have, Your Honor. I believe in several cases where the claims against that one party are interrelated with the claims against other parties who continue.
But that's, of course, not the way. That's not the way the rule describes it. It's a separate claim or a separate party. The problems come in when you try to separate claims from each other. But if there's a separate party, it looks as if the rule just authorizes the appeal. If you're completely getting rid of a party, the fact there's overlap doesn't matter. Otherwise, you wouldn't need that separate party provision in the rule, right? If it were just a matter of overlapping claims.
Well,
I mean, you're saying if the claims overlap, you can't dismiss the party. But if that's true, you wouldn't have this separate party provision in the rule.
Well, as I understand it, Your Honor, the Rule 54B rule is an exception to the normal rule of one appeal per case.
Of course it is. But it's a particular exception which speaks separately of claims and parties.
Understood. But
if you want us, what in your view is your best case for the proposition that a district judge lacks the authority to enter a Rule 54B judgment on a party if that party is related to other claims still pending?
The best case that we cite in our briefs for that, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm. Or the best case that you know, whether you've cited it or not. Although I hope you've cited your best cases.
I believe we have, Your Honor. Your Honor, I believe that would be the Horwitz case.
That's a separate claims case. It is not a separate parties case. All right.
See, if you look at the text.
Go ahead.
Well, if you just look at the text of 54B, I mean, it's really clear, which, you know, we don't get that often. But when an action presents more than one claim for relief or when multiple parties are involved, which implies you can have one claim But if you have multiple parties, the judge can dismiss one of the parties. I don't think it could be much clearer.
But we have multiple claims against all.
Yes, I know. But if given the rule, and if your best case is Horowitz, this argument's going nowhere. So let's turn to subject matter jurisdiction. Why is there any?
Subject matter jurisdiction,
Before you leave that first question, why wouldn't you have wanted to have a Rule 54 judgment entered so you could raise this issue right away?
We believe that the motion to dismiss that was granted, the court obviously did not reach the merits of the personal jurisdiction issue. It didn't reach the merits of the alter ego grounds on which we were asserting personal jurisdiction. We would have continued to engage in discovery. We would have sought to amend.
I had the same question Judge Evans did. Why do you want to continue hassling in the district court with a judge who's unfavorable to you and go back and ask him to reconsider and more discovery and all this stuff, rather than just present your case here?
We believe that we have a very strong case for establishing meeting the prima facie case standard at the motion to dismiss stage. And we believe that we could have realleged in our complaint additional facts, although we believe the facts in our complaint and in our opposition to the motion to dismiss were more than enough to satisfy the standard.
Realleging facts? What do you have to reallege facts in a complaint for?
Complaints are irrelevant at this stage of the litigation.
Well, Your Honor, we have never completed discovery because of the judge's ruling on them.
You don't have to reallege facts in order in your complaint, file an amended complaint in order to do discovery.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor, although the court's May decision granting the motion to dismiss suggests that that is the course we would have to engage in.
But that's another error that you should be raising on appeal. Anyway, let's get to subject matter jurisdiction. Is there any? This looks like a contract dispute.
This is.
You say the other guys owed you a certain amount of money and they haven't paid it, and that's fine. The terms of the contract might have been set by the federal tariffs. But the fact that federal law influences the terms of the contract doesn't change the fact that it's a contract dispute.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that I don't have a case with me today, but I believe it is well recognized that claims for enforcement of a federal tariff, that is for payments of goods and services provided under a federal tariff, and those are, I believe, four of the claims that we asserted below were claims for payments under a federal tariff. Those claims are claims that bring in federal question jurisdiction under Section 1331.
How do they arise under federal law? Case arises under federal law if the plaintiff wins if federal law means one thing and loses if federal law means another thing. But there is, so far as I can tell, nothing. No federal dispute in this case. It's just, did they pay or didn't they?
Well, the question is, do we have a claim under our tariffs? Did they comply with their obligations under the tariffs? Those are federal tariffs. Those are tariffs which are part of a federal program around which a whole body of law, including all the cases of the federal tariff doctrine, the filed tariff doctrine, have been created, because it's recognized that that tariff program is designed to prevent non-discrimination among customers. That is, all customers should be paying the same amounts for the rates and services that they're purchasing under the federal tariff. And here,
that sounds like an argument that if you tried to charge a different rate than the tariff, the other side would have an affirmative defense of deviation from the tariff. But anticipating a federal defense, which actually has never been advanced, doesn't create federal jurisdiction. That's a pretty basic rule. I think, since this, I don't want to consume the oral argument doing this, the statute that's relied on in the brief is 47 U.S.C. 207, but 207 says that the plaintiff can sue in a court of, quote, competent jurisdiction, and that leaves open the question whether a given court has jurisdiction. It doesn't say that any claim to recover a tariff rate arises under federal law. So I think we need briefs from the parties about this. There are all sorts of federal statutes. Copyright is a good example. And the copyright holder has a federal right, but if the copyright holder signs a license to somebody else to publish his book, any dispute about whether the royalties have been paid arises under the contract, not under the copyright law. And the question I'm asking is, why isn't this the same thing?
Well, there is no separate contract, as in the royalty case, that parties enter into in a commercial context. There is a tariff that must be filed with a federal agency, and that applies to anybody purchasing goods and services under that tariff. But we would be happy to brief the subject matter jurisdiction issue, Your Honor.
Each side should file briefs on subject matter jurisdiction within 10 days. All right, and now, Mr. Binet, you can actually get to the merits.
I believe I'm going into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, so I'll try to be very brief. But on the first point of error, we believe the district court erred in concluding that the allegations in Illinois Bell's complaint failed to make out a prima facie case for the district court having personal jurisdiction over Ferris Minor. At the motion to dismiss stage, the hurdle that Illinois Bell needed to clear on this issue is relatively low. Courts in this circuit have described the test at the motion to dismiss stage as whether the plaintiff has made a prima facie, colorable, or minimally viable case for the court's exercise of personal jurisdiction. The ultimate constitutional question to which the colorable, minimally viable, or prima facie test is applied is the question of due process under the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court has formulated the constitutional question as whether the defendant has sufficient minimum contacts with the foreign state such that the exercise of personal jurisdiction by a court in that state comports with traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice.
That sounds like complete fog. Is there any actual concrete thing you can say about what it is that permits personal jurisdiction here?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In its briefs with the district court below, Ferris Minor focused on the alleged lack of contacts that it has with Illinois in a formal sense as Ferris Minor, as the corporate entity named Ferris Minor. But that misses the point here. Ferris Minor is the parent of all the other defendants. Illinois Bell alleged in its complaint that Ferris Minor and all the other defendants are alter egos of each other, are operated as a single economic unit,
care what Illinois Bell alleged in the complaint. I'm asking for something concrete. What is the concrete thing that you say supports personal jurisdiction? Now, this is you're operating on an alter ego theory. What's your best reason to think that corporate formalities have been ignored and the other usual alter ego requirements have been met?
Here's the best reason, Your Honor. The entity that has the interconnection agreement with Illinois Bell that ostensibly ordered the products and services from Illinois Bell in Illinois, that delivered traffic to Illinois Bell, incurred liabilities from Illinois Bell, is a fictional company. It is a facade. It has no employees. It has no assets whatsoever. It has no customers. It is simply an instrumentality for Ferris Minor, which is the parent, which is the sole shareholder. That is our best set of facts. There are many additional facts that we allege and that we provided in our response opposing the motion to dismiss, but that is the best set of facts. I think at this point I will conclude and save whatever time I have left for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Fowler.
May it please the Court, my name is Phil Fowler, and I represent Ferris Minor. Starting with the 54B language, I think this issue was decided by this Court, and Judge Easterbrook wrote the opinion in the
doesn't make any difference who writes the Court's opinion.
Case where the Court, it was exactly what happened here. Defendant was dismissed based on long-arm jurisdiction, lack of personal jurisdiction. 54B was granted. We cited this case at page 28 of our brief, and the Seventh Circuit said that was proper. That's what should happen. The all of the matters as to that party were resolved. It was a final judgment. It was certified properly under 54B that there was no just reason to delay enforcement of the repeal, and the court said that was fine, and it is.
You say you cited it, page 28 of your brief. Is that it, both of your briefs? Why do we have both sealed and redacted briefs in this case?
Part of the documentation that was sealed originally in the trial court because it involved financial information and dealings, financial information and pricing information.
There's none of that in these so-called confidential briefs.
The things that are blacked out in the supposedly redacted briefs are, for example, the name of the person who made a particular declaration. How can the name of a person who made an affidavit in a case be confidential? This is bizarre.
It's possible that we erred on the side of over-inclusion because we had, we were under the protective order. We petitioned this court to have those protected orders put in place once we got the notice that you're going to unseal them within 10 days, and so we followed the same procedures we did below. Perhaps we erred on the side of over-inclusion.
I didn't see anything in the briefs that was confidential.
All right.
We
did have an order in place at the trial court. This court allowed it to stay in place here, and so we followed it. And if we were incorrect in doing so, I apologize for that. But, as a lawyer, I want to be very, very, very careful that we're not violating protective orders. Maybe it was improvidently granted, but I want to make sure that we're in compliance. And if we erred on the side of over-inclusion, I apologize. I know the court's position with respect policies with respect to sitting things in the Seventh Circuit, and that's why we asked to do it. I think, if does that answer your question? Thank you. With respect to, I think I can move on from 54B unless you have any other issues relative to that. With respect to the subject matter jurisdiction, I don't feel comfortable speaking off the cuff, and the courts have allowed me to file a brief within 10 days, and I would rather do that unless you have some specific questions of me on that issue, if that's okay with the court.
Was this subject addressed ever in the district court?
Yes. A subject matter was addressed in the district court after Ferris Minor was dismissed from the district court. The remaining defendants filed a motion to dismiss based on subject matter jurisdiction. I didn't prep that argument. I don't have all the particulars, but in large part they said since the interconnection agreement is what's governing this case, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, that under the law that the Commerce Commission had to take a first crack at determining whether or not there was a breach interconnection agreement.
I'm not raising a primary jurisdiction question.
I understand that. Right. That issue, best of my recollection, was not addressed yet, and will be addressed within the next 10
days. If subject matter jurisdiction, as distinct from primary jurisdiction, is a question that's been raised and ruled on in the district court, the party should provide us with a copy of the district court's disposition as well.
Okay, those are already in the record, but I'll send courtesy copies if you'd like.
It wouldn't be in the appellate record if it occurred after the appeal was taken.
For some reason, we checked and it was. I don't know why it was transmitted, but I will provide the court with copies of those with my filings.
Thank you.
Okay. We checked the record yesterday and it was in there for some reason. With respect to the merits and the concrete matters, the reality is not all of the defendants that were sued, not all of the Global NAP entities, moved to dismiss this case, the alter ego claims. Realty did not, Networks did not, New Hampshire did, and Ferris Minor did. With respect to Ferris Minor, I think in the briefs at least, I don't think that it's our position that the plaintiff isn't being forthright in terms of what their burden is. And the court mentioned we don't really care what's in the pleadings at this stage. Affidavits were filed by Frank Ganji of Ferris Minor. And once that affidavit is filed, they can't rest on contradictory allegations in the complaint.
Mr. Benig was very emphatic that the Illinois a corporation, has no assets, no employees, no customers, nothing. Now, is that just an allegation, and then you have some counter affidavit, or is there some evidence?
No, there's meat to that, and what he's there's meat to that allegation. It's not just in the complaint. Global Naps Illinois actually filed a request to admit that was attached to Mr. Benning's brief in opposition, where they admitted that they had no assets and no employees at this juncture. But they did have the asset that they have was the certificate of public convenience.
That's a little thin, though.
Well, and actually, the issue is being litigated before the Commerce Commission.
That would rather eliminate veil piercing, wouldn't it? Because it would say, well, can't pierce the veil of a corporation because every corporation has at least one asset, its certificate.
Well, the certificate allows it to operate. Phone
sure,
services in Illinois.
Should allow it, you know, to fly to the moon, right?
Right.
But if it doesn't have any assets or employees, it's not going to do anything with the certificate.
Well, but see, that's where we got to be careful here, Your Honor, because you can't lump everybody together, because the entity that is providing the services by which they can operate under that certificate is Networks. And that's pled in the complaint, and they're in the case. And that issue, whether there's sufficient facts,
but wait, if
Global, the Networks will be litigated.
If Global Illinois is an alter ego of Ferris Minor, then that seems to me quite enough to have Ferris Minor in the case. It may be that Ferris Minor wouldn't be liable substantively on activities of some other things that were real corporations. But if Global Naps Illinois is properly in the case and it is an alter ego of Ferris Minor, then Ferris Minor is in the case.
That's right. But that's the issue here, is whether it's the alter ego of Ferris Minor.
You just said it admitted that it was not only a shell corporation, it was the emptiest kind of shell one could imagine.
Well, Global Naps Illinois admitted that. The issue, though, is why is that?
It was created by Ferris Minor, wasn't it?
Ferris Minor is the sole shareholder of the corporation.
Right. Okay, so that's what piercing the veil is. You pierce to the shareholder. So you have a completely empty corporation. You have a sole shareholder, Ferris Minor. So you go through the corporate form, and there you find the
Ferris
sole
Minor.
Shareholder.
No, the funding for Ferris Minor's revenues are in.
So what? What difference does that make?
Hampshire.
Look,
isn't
it piercing the veil is going after the shareholder of the corporate shell, and this is the shareholder, and you stop there. The fact the shareholder has other investments, that doesn't make any sense.
I would disagree. In the Moran case is the case that I believe would decide this particular issue.
Doesn't make any sense. You know, you used to have these New York corporations. They incorporate every taxi cab separately in order to limit their liability. So the court said, you pierce the veil, you go to the owner. The owner couldn't say, we can't pierce the veil because this is just one cab that hit you, and I have 299 others. I mean, that's just a complete non sequitur response.
But Moran addresses this. The fact that the corporation might not have assets, the fact that the assets might have been moved to another corporation, and Delaware law is what applies here with respect to veil piercing. And just because those facts exist doesn't mean that that situation exists because of fraud. And that's the nexus.
No,
you have
look,
to show
look,
that Ferris Minor controlled.
There is a connection between veil piercing and fraud, because if you know you're dealing with a completely assetless company and you sign contracts with them, you're taking the risk, that's fine. You can't complain. But you don't actually have to prove fraud. All you have to prove is that the corporation you dealt with really, you know, had nothing. And then you sue the shareholders or shareholder, and that's all that's involved.
Judge,
you're complicating this with all sorts of stuff that it doesn't make any sense what you're saying.
Well, I'm complicating it with what the Delaware courts say the Delaware law is, which is what we have to apply here. And that's what the Moran case said.
What's the sense of it? The shareholder takes all the assets and employees and everything out of the corporation, leaving it a complete shell, and moves it somewhere else. And so what is the plaintiff supposed to do? Go chasing after all the affiliates of the,
they're
of
in.
The shell? What's that about?
They're in. And that'll be litigated. The issue is whether or not that happened because it was directed by Ferris Viner. And there's no evidence that it was. And, in fact, the affidavit of Frank Ganji with respect to it is completely contradicted. This is just a holding company that files a tax return like millions of companies throughout the United States. The entities that share the revenue, the entities that provide the service for the company that issues the certificate of public.
If a holding company empties out the owner has to take responsibility for what's going on in his companies. If he has shells, he can't walk away from it and say, well, it's a shell, but
it's got to be Ferris Minor, and there's no nexus to Ferris Minor. If networks, if the people of networks,
and the company.
Pardon me?
It owns the company.
That's the facts. He owns the company, and he says, I don't direct the operations of this company. And they have arrangements with the other two companies, and that's where it's a banking arrangement, and that entity is in the case, and the company that provides the services for the certificate.
I think we're hitting on a potential additional question that maybe should be addressed in these subject matter jurisdiction briefs. You say Delaware law controls, and
right.
Delaware insists on proof of fraud.
Yes.
Now, of course, the Supreme Court held in the Best Foods case that for investor liability, when the claim arises under federal law, state law governs the terms of investors' liability, shareholders' liability, veil piercing, as it's often called, unless the state enforcement of the state rule would undermine some federal interest.
Right.
And if there is a distinct source of federal law here, you could imagine a state rule that says only fraud would permit veil piercing to undermine a federal interest. Because if Global Naps Illinois has a right under the federal tariff to be the customer, and it arrives and says, I have a federal right to be your customer and agree to pay this federal tariff. And, oh, by the way, you should understand I have no assets and I'm never going to pay you. You must provide the service to me as a matter of federal law. And I've carefully organized in Delaware. And since I've told you I'm a no-asset corporation, you can never claim fraud later. Ha, ha, ha. Right? That sounds like the kind of circumstance that under Best Foods would require the application of a federal veil-piercing doctrine as opposed to a state veil-piercing doctrine. So I think we've got tied up with the question of whether there is a distinct federal claim as opposed to a contract claim. We've got a related question about whether application of a fraud-only piercing doctrine would justify the adoption of a federal common law under Best Foods. So sorry to complicate your task, but these seem to me tied up.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the Best case, but this case, this
Best
was...
Best Foods.
Best
that's,
Foods.
That's its name. It's one word.
Best Foods. The issue was touched on in the briefs, though, when we studied to the Supreme Court case of Peacock, which refused to... said that basically ERISA is not going... You know, it's not enough of a federal interest to apply veil piercing, which is really just a collection mechanism, and state law would apply in that instance. I think that is pretty good precedent here, but I'll have to review the Best Foods case, and we'll address it as you directed us to. The court doesn't have any further questions of me. I'd just like to wrap up. I don't think the court was wrong in court was not wrong in the first instance. I do believe in Delaware law applies. There's no evidence of fraud. There's no evidence that these instances were directed by Ferris Minor. And furthermore, the court was definitely correct in failing to review or consider basically documents that were in the plaintiff's possession as early as February, because they filed the same Solomon affidavit saying he looked at the same stuff in February of 07 within days of us filing our motion to dismiss. They never asked for veil piercing discovery. They didn't want it. How do I know that? And this is in the record because when in their brief they said that they had served discovery. Am I out of time, Your Honor?
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Binnick, you take the risk that if you say anything further, I may add a third subject to the
Your Honor, I'm willing to take that risk. Just briefly, I would like to point out that the question of whether federal common law applied to the veil-piercing analysis was raised by us in our opposition to the motion to dismiss, and we'll be happy to include additional argument on that in our briefs in 10 days. But I should point out that Delaware law on veil-piercing does not strictly require proof of fraud per se. It simply requires either fraud or some similar type of injustice, and we would assert that that clearly is met in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.